as guitarist Jay Leach in a piece that he calls Emmaus. You know, that's the challenge with instrumental pieces. They could be very peaceful and spiritual, but you'd never know until you hear the title, if you don't recognize the melody. You know, if it's not a familiar hymn, for example, you can go, what is that I'm hearing? Well, it's called Emmaus, and it's a nice piece by a session guitarist on the West Coast and does a lot of Christian music. He's by trade a pedal steel guy. Playing in country bands, but he's got a lot of talent and a lot of musical styles. Jay Leach is his name. 12 minutes after the hour, and Dr. Don Clark joins us from Garden Valley, Texas. Don is a biochemist and member of the board of Creation Moments, and we're pleased to have him here again. We're going to talk about Cosmic Dust, but Don off the air was just telling us about a concert he attended. This is the reason that you're a little groggy today? Late hours?
Oh, it's just kind of carrying on.
Life in the fast lane, I guess.
I'm not getting enough sleep. But anyway, went to a Lindsey Graham concert in Dallas, and it was at the Southside Ballroom in downtown Dallas. But I'd never been to a venue like this before where you have to stand up. I mean, and you're standing the whole time. So the concert started at 8. We got there at 7:30, and Lindsey Graham didn't come on until 9.
Oh, my goodness.
And she played for an hour and a half, which I was kind of surprised at because it was pretty much constant music. I mean, she talked a little bit and had, some of her videos, but it was, for the most part, constant playing.
Mm-hmm.
And the standing was a bit much, you know, for me and my family. But the concert, once she finally got on, I mean, the concert was great. And we enjoyed it, you know, thoroughly. But it was 1 o'clock, you know, in the morning by the time we get back home here to Garden Valley, Texas.
Okay.
Wow.
Well, life in the fast lane, Don, that it's meant for younger folk. You know, 10:30 is bedtime.
You would think. But yeah. Didn't quite make it that mm-hmm. night. And then had a late night last night, because doing this program in one of the prisons here in Texas, and our group is kind of piloting this program. It's called Malachi Dads, and the purpose of the program is to get the fathers back united with their children, and the children back to the fathers. And so it's... there's a workbook that goes with the program, and there's about a 45-minute open discussion, open teaching, and then we break up into small groups and then go through
Let me ask a question. That sounds like a worthwhile ministry, but I'm not sure I understand the crux of it. These are men who are in prison, so they're necessarily separated from their families, but somehow your ministry brings their kids back to them for visits. Does it heal relationships? Both of the you know, all of the above. How does that work?
First we go through the gospel message pretty thoroughly. Mm-hmm. So if they aren't saved, they become saved. Most of them that we are teaching right now are saved and have. Some have been saved for quite some time, but others have not. And so we're making sure they have a good understanding of the gospel. And then it will be, we'll talk about marriage and the function of marriage, and talk about the dad's role in the family. Mm-hmm. But all of this time, they are to write their children, and some have not written their children or have even heard from their children for 15 plus years.
Oh, my goodness.
And so in writing their children, then they make connections with their children again. And throughout their program, there'll be probably Saturday afternoons or Saturdays where the kids will come to the prison, and there'll be a time of physical, you know, reuniting with, mm-hmm. With their kids. So the purpose is to build that bridge and to build that relationship. The ultimate purpose really is to keep the kids out of prison, because studies have been shown that the children of inmates wind up going to jail themselves in about 80% of the cases. Mm-hmm. This program originated in Louisiana, in Angola, one of the bloodiest prisons in the country, and it has flourished in that prison, and now it's one of the most peaceful prisons in America.
All right.
So the the prisoners then tell other prisoners about Jesus, and they come to know the Lord, and they, of course, want to make connections with their kids, and it kind of spreads from there.
And prisoners, especially males, it seemed. I don't have a whole lot of information on female prisoners, but Doug Greenwald, our friend Doug, who joins us on Wednesdays, has been doing prison ministries in recent years with his Preserving Bible Times programs, and it talks about how receptive inmates usually are. It may be because they're pressed and they're desperate, maybe because they're bored and lonely, but whatever the motivation is, they seem particularly open and sincerely open to the gospel message.
Oh, they are. Of course, not all of them, and it depends on their situation. But they really want to know about Jesus and really want to do, what's right. Mm-hmm. You get questions when you're in your small group. You get questions like, how do I, stop the guy from, cutting in front of me? You always have these bullies, and especially in prison, you're going to have a lot of bullies. And so how do you stop the guy, in front of you from cutting in line, in the meal line? And, of course, the answer to that is you don't. You just let him go, and you don't worry about it. Mm-hmm. And little things like that to, exploding at the guards because mm-hmm. they're not treating you with respect. And just those type of things. And then, of course, if and when you get out of prison, then how do you make that transition back into life mm-hmm. is yet another problem. But that's why you need kind of transition centers.
Malachi Fathers sounds like an ambitious project and a good one.
Malachi Dads.
Malachi Dads. Okay. Mm-hmm. We're looking at an article from UPI.com today. In fact, normally when Don comes on, we talk about creation and evolution and science and faith and topics in that range. This is about cosmic dust today. And it's an article by Brooke Hayes. It's dated July the 10th over at UPI.com. We'll link it to our podcast later. But they're making some claims for cosmic dust, and Don, I'm wondering what you think about this. They're saying they've resolved some age-old problems with cosmic dust and learning how new matter is formed in the universe. What do you think?
Well, I mean, yeah, it's an interesting article, and the UPI, of course, never gives enough information for you to critically review it. And unfortunately, the original article is in Nature, and unless you pay for a subscription, you only get the abstract, which mm-hmm. pretty much says what's in the article. But the gist of it is, and the UPS story, story actually starts off with a evolutionary explanation how planets are formed. Mm-hmm. And so that kind of builds your interest and say, okay, they found out how planets are formed, and therefore you've got cosmic evolution is actually true after all. And no, that's not what they're really saying, even though they said that in the mm-hmm. in the first sentence of the article. The whole premise was that, cosmic dust is the stuff that planets are made of. And, we used to be told that planets came from the star that was in the, in the center of, let's take our solar system. And the planets kind of spun out, from the star that was in the center of the solar system. But now, of course, they're saying, because of evidence against that, saying that, there was cosmic dust, and then the cosmic dust coalesces to form these planets and the planets that we see and have today. We talked about something last week the week before that, with regard to finding a boatload or three oceans load of water under the Earth's crust. Mm-hmm. which would argue strongly against planets being formed from the cosmic dust. But this article basically says that a supernova, during a supernova explosion, because they watched one recently, and they give the supernova, SN2010JL, is the supernova, and it was in the galaxy UGC 5189A, if anybody's interested,
or yeah, about 100. That, yeah.
About 160 million light years away.
Need some more creative
Earth.
Names, I think, on these things. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's a way of cataloging.
I suppose.
You know what you see in the sky. After all, there's only 11 trillion stars per every person on the planet Earth.
That's
the universe.
It's a lot of names. Yeah. Okay.
So you need a way of saying I'm talking about this particular one. Mm-hmm. anyway, they observed they were looking, kind of scanning the skies for a star that was about ready to explode, and they found one. This one that I just mentioned. And so they watched it explode, and then they took a spectral analysis of the explosion and the aftermath for about 2 years, about 30 months. And lo and behold, they began to see, dust particles, and they say large dust particles of 1 micron, of up to 1 micron. Mm-hmm. Now, 1 micron is not that big.
It's, thousandth of a
millimeter.
Mm.
But they were very excited about this and saying, well, and the reason... it looks like there is an initial, there's an initial explosion with a supernova or a star exploding that threw off some gas and some building materials for the dust, which was very hot. And then when the star finally exploded, the supernova finally exploded, the shock wave, they hypothesized the shock wave from the explosion then compressed the gas and formed these particles, and somehow the particles, by this compression, cooled down, and then was cool enough to nucleate these dust particles. But like I said in the beginning, there isn't enough information there to say yes, that actually happened. Let's suppose that it did, and it happened the way they're saying. Or was that dust particle there initially? But this is the whole premise here is cosmic evolution. It's has nothing to do with.
Well, it is, and there's an assumption in the very first paragraph, and this is not scientific, but this is what captures my attention in the whole article. I'll just read the first paragraph. It's a story out of Aarhus, Denmark, dated July 10th. It says, "For a while now, scientists have known about cosmic dust, that it exists and that it builds planets. They also had hypothesized it was formed by stellar explosions," and then a parenthetical statement. Where else would it have come from? I mean,
well, yeah, like God speaking it into existence. I mean,
they wouldn't so. Even. I mean, what that parenthetical statement says is we wouldn't consider anything like that. Of course, it's got to come from where the scientists had hypothesized it to come from. No other options available, and that's just not very scientific, is it?
No, it's not, and it's to make definitive statements, and evolutionists do this all the time. It doesn't matter which field that they're in, but they make these definitive statements like, this is fact. We know this to be the case, yet they have never, and I'm going to repeat this, they have never found any stars to be born. I mean, about every 30 years or so, stars are observed to explode, and hence this was one of them. But they have never found one to form. Mm. So where is their evidence for cosmic evolution if you're not forming stars? And they got all excited because they think they've found the source of cosmic dust, which is kind of in their theory is the first thing that you need in order to form planets. So it just astounds me how far they go with this. And maybe cosmic dust is formed from the explosion of supernovas. They originally were thought, well, you know, supernova is a very violent event, and that's going to blow up any dust that might be in space. But now they think they have the evidence that it's actually forming. But how do you get from cosmic dust to a planet, and how do you get, from a planet to a solar system? Is great leaps of faith in my book, at least, because just stuff floating around doesn't necessarily come together.
What this all reminds me of is something in sales training. It would be called the assumptive close. You know, when you close a sales presentation, one of the techniques is to assume that your customer is going to buy. In other words, that they have accepted your arguments, your persuasiveness, and so forth. This article does the same thing by just saying matter-of-factly that this galaxy is 160 million light years from Earth. Well, of course, that sounds very scientific, and they're saying, in effect, it's established fact, when actually they don't know how far that is, huh? I mean, because of variations in the speed of light, things we've talked about on the show before, they're assuming you'll buy into this, and so therefore the conclusion seems logical to you when you don't necessarily accept the starting premise.
Well, exactly, and if you don't, they've said it enough times that you should accept the starting premise. At least that's the way the theory goes. if you say something often enough, people begin to believe it. I'm not so concerned about the distance away it is, because you can do such things as triangulation out to a certain point in space and figure out, okay, well, you know, I'm looking at this light source from two different spots on the Earth now, separated for quite a distance, and I can do, you know, just like regular navigation, I can triangulate and see how far I am from that light source. And but obviously the further out in space you go, that there is a limitation, because you've got a very tiny arc, which is the diameter of the Earth.
A tiny
that you're
base
looking at
when
this.
You triangulate, the accuracy is proportional to the distance of the baseline.
And, right, so the further out you go, the less accurate you are. But 160 million light years, that's not too far, especially when the edge of the galaxy is supposed to be 13.8 billion light years away. So the premise of going from, well, we just created cosmic dust, and from that we go to planets and get solar systems, and the whole story starts to build on itself. And that's exactly what it is. It's a story, because we know that from Genesis 1 that God created everything by speaking it into existence, and by forming these things himself, at least the planets and the stars, and he created the Earth, and then from his initial creation, then he placed the stars in the firmament of the heaven, and so these things were placed out there when the start of creation occurred, and I believe it was 6,000 years ago. Mm-hmm. So, of course, these folks would argue vehemently against that.
Well, I have a kind of a metaphysical question for you. Why is it we care how these things are formed? I mean, to what benefit do we go to all this effort, all these resources, trying to resolve these things, discovering the how, when it's really the why of things that's most important? I mean, if we decide that cosmic dust forms planets, so what? How does that change our, why are we searching for this information to begin with?
Well, it's a worldview. If your whole assumption is you want to prove evolution, and that's the only way things happen, then ultimately you are trying to do away with the Creator and do away with the biblical account of creation, and say, aha, you see, the account is not correct. Everything was formed by evolution, and that's why we came up with cosmic evolution, to give us an answer as to how we can explain things away, how we can explain God away simply from, if you will, cosmic mechanics naturally go on. Yeah, we should care. I mean, I am all for investigating how the universe is built, and because the more we investigate, the more we see God's glory. I mean, after all, Scripture says the heavens declare the glory of God. So looking at the heavens, trying to figure out how the heavens are put together and what's out there in the heavens will declare the glory of God if you have the right worldview and the right assumptions.
Mm-hmm. Well, interesting process, and I agree with you. And that's kind of the way science started. We've talked about that here many times, how when science really first came around at the beginning of the Industrial Age and in the Age of Enlightenment, it was, let's see how God works here. How does he do these things? And it gradually shifted into, well, it's got to be anything but God. It's got to be something we can see, taste, feel, hear. You know, our own senses have to verify, to validate what we see in order to be a reasonable and accurate explanation. And we simply don't take into account things that are bigger than we are. And it leads us to studies like this. David, any thoughts?
Well, there was a technical thought that I had earlier in the conversation. Is that, do the scientists going to have to redo the number of years that the universe has been in existence now? Is there enough time for this dust collecting thing to take place, or is that the latest? Is that going to be the next headline?
well, they didn't. They certainly didn't speak to that. But with 13.8 billion years to play with, they, I'm sure, are not concerned with how much time it takes to form this dust. And apparently, the dust formed within the 2-year period of following the explosion of the star. If indeed this pans out to be accurate. Now, how long does it take for the cosmic dust to accumulate into formed planets? That's a big assumption, and it's a big assumption even if it's going to do that. And there's no thermodynamic reason, at least, or no physical reason why the dust thrown out into space is going to coalesce into a solid, bigger than 1 micron. Mm-hmm. That's the bigger question for me. Just because you do happen to say, well, okay, maybe some dust can be formed through these explosions. How do you get it to coalesce into a solid object as big as a planet?
Is this the kind of thing you can reproduce in a laboratory or an experiment? It doesn't seem to be, but maybe. If you could work on a small scale like that.
Well, you've got, of course, the argument is, well, the tiny particles, they have a little bit of gravity, and, so they're going to be attracted to each other, through mutual gravity. But, as you just heard, these things were bombarded by a, supernova explosion, which is a pretty big shock wave. And the shock wave was apparently enough to compress the gas. And perhaps, the thought is that maybe perhaps another shock wave from another supernova might be enough to actually pull these particles together. And the story, kind of goes on. It takes multiple shock waves from these supernovas to build up enough condensed matter to, I hate to use the word, but for it to matter and for it to make a planet.
Little scientific humor there, David.
But yeah, this is just assumption after assumption after assumption. And that's the interesting thing about the human mind. I mean, we are creative, but we can come up with explanations built on very, very little evidence.
Mm-hmm. Is this particular article, and I don't know if the article Nature, does it necessarily have to go through other scientists to be vetted or to be looked at, or... I can't believe that anybody would be able to send an article into Nature without at least somebody else looking at it and saying, this could be, or this is totally whacked, and forget it.
The Nature, the magazine, or the journal Nature, is a peer-reviewed journal.
Okay.
Just like many scientific journals, Nature is a well-respected peer-reviewed journal. Now, I'm sure in the Nature, well, I'm not sure because I don't have the whole article, but in the at least in the abstract of the Nature article, which is referenced in this UPI story, they only talk about the dust being formed and a mechanism for the dust being formed. They don't talk about the evolutionary, the statement like was in this UPI news release. That's the UPI scientific writers are adding that twist to make it newsworthy and for people to start reading it. Mm-hmm. Now, I hope that, a statement like that isn't in the Nature article, because if it is, then obviously science is very, very biased, which, of course, we know that to begin with. But for a peer review article to even allow that type of statement would be very poor, science,
Well, we'll link to this article in our podcast, which will be up on our website here in a couple of hours. So if you can check this out yourself, you want and follow those links and learn more about cosmic dust. Again, Dr. Don Clark, a biochemist, a member of the Board of Creation Moments. I want to recommend that you visit the Creation Moments website. You can link to it from ours at Broken Road Radio, And you'll find a lot of information there regarding the young Earth creationist point of view, including scientific information, which often doesn't come to the surface. Sometimes you have to search that out, and you'll find ample scientific support for the position there. And it's recommended reading, creationmoments.com, and you can link to it again from Broken Road Radio. Don, as always, we're grateful to you. Thank you for joining us today.
Well, you're quite welcome. It's been fun as usual.
We have to recover from the concert and get back out of the vineyard. Maybe, I guess you don't work out there at night, do you?
No.
Little helmets with lights on.
If we had bright lights, maybe we should work at night, not during the day. It's supposed to get above 100 again today.
Well, nighttime work makes more sense then, because you get a helmet with those little lights on, little spotlights, and you could do your pruning and wine. Yeah, Don also raising grapes for wine. So, Don, we'll check in with you next week, see what's new then, okay?
Okay,
see you, Don.
Bye-bye.
So long.